This is Robert Rogers from Parkinson's Recovery, and it is my delight and pleasure to have Carl Buchart with me, who is an expert, a national renowned expert in neuro-linguistic programming. And so I really want to start out with, that's a mouthful. What in the world is neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP?
NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and by the way, hi, Robert, is a methodology. It's about coming up on 40 years old now since its inception. It's a methodology for understanding and changing human experience, which is to say what things mean and how we behave and just about everything that we think and do and feel. And it came out of at the University of California, Santa Cruz, not officially. The people who started it were a student there and a linguistics professor there at UC Santa Cruz named John Grinder and Richard Bandler. Bandler was the student, Grinder the linguistics professor. And they got interested in understanding how it was that certain people in certain professions having to do with communication or healing or change, how it was that certain of these practitioners or therapists or experts or teachers and so forth were extraordinarily good at what they did, and their clients or their patients or their students got wonderful results. And then there was a whole much larger group of people who were in the same fields with essentially the same kinds of training and certainly the same good hearts and wonderful intentions, but they weren't extremely good at what they did. And so what Richard and John and the group that formed around them in the middle 70s were wondering essentially, what is the difference that makes the difference between people who are extremely good at doing communication and change work and people who are not and would like to be, yet they're still not. So that was the start of it, and it's been growing and developing hugely for, quite a long time now, like 30 years plus, obviously. And it has to do now with some ways of understanding and changing experience at the level of behavior, which is what we do internally and externally. So internal behavior would be, if one were thinking about going skiing, would be making pictures of going skiing. External behavior, obviously, would be going skiing. And there's change of work that we do at the level of capability, which is to sort of take behavior and move it around inside someone's map of reality a little bit and connect it up so it works a bit more elegantly or a lot more elegantly than it did before. And then the really interesting and important territory as well is what we call change at the level of belief, change at the level of identity, which is our beliefs about ourselves, and then we do system-level change, the larger system that holds the person in place, kind of on in their place on planet Earth, in their place in the families, in their families and the families they're descended from. So that's my 30-second answer, and obviously it takes about 5 minutes to do.
Right. Can NLP be used by people who have the symptoms of Parkinson's, who would like to be able to find some relief from their symptoms?
I've worked with a number of folks who have Parkinson's symptoms, and the answer is yes, and I'm sure like all, just about everyone else you're talking to, unless they're the one person you should be talking to instead of me, it's a really, really, really difficult territory. What we're typically wanting to pay attention to, which we always do when we're doing any kind of change work in the NLP model, is as preposterous as this question may sound, what are the intended positive outcomes of the symptoms of the illness? We presuppose that all experience, all behavior, Parkinson's included, however difficult it is, it's all prompted from some kind of intended positive outcome. Now the question is, for which version of us, where and when, because when people are in such distress with the symptoms, it's really, really difficult to imagine that there could be anything positive trying to happen, as I'm sure everyone can easily imagine. So what we usually do is ask the first question we always ask when we do NLP-based change work, which is, what would you like? And that can take 2 hours to answer, obviously, or it can take 2 days. And then we ask, and what will having that do for you? And is there anything you might lose that you value when you have the outcome that you would like? And I've had some experience with people who shifted their symptoms quite a bit, and many other people, several other people, not at all. So I have a mixed report.
So that would be maybe 50-50, about half got better and half there was no change?
I would probably put it, I'm sorry to say it, about half, or maybe slightly less than half, like 45 or something like that. The belief system that we I have very often found sitting underneath the symptoms of Parkinson's, and as you know, Robert, this can come through the individual's personal experience, or this can be downloaded through their family system, is a commitment to an entanglement with and a sort of apparently unstoppable focus on not having choice about movement. It's sort of the opposite of the metaphor of paralysis. The metaphor that we find in Parkinson's is a metaphor of something along the lines of, I will never stop moving and you can't make me stop. Now, where that comes from, what intended positives it serves, where it is generationally in the family system, all of that is, as you might imagine, just like completely individual, kind of handcrafted identity and reality. So it's hard to make a generalization about it, except the one about not having choice about moving.
So you noticed in the work that you've done with people who have Parkinson's, there are a lot of idiosyncratic and individual differences across persons.
Of course, always. What we usually find is that the common element, which again is not completely 100% common, but seems to be there enough to be able to make, to at least hazard this like beginning of a generalization, that these are folks who somehow or other were not permitted to, and when I say not permitted to, that can mean just about anything. It can be a child who is forbidden, sometimes a generation or two or three back. Someone who wanted to leave some place, a relationship, a place, a time, a country, and was not able to or not permitted to. This has a way of flipping itself upside down, and somebody later on, and this is the person with the symptoms, ends up saying at some level in their attention and their consciousness, it's certainly anywhere but conscious, but saying, I will fix this for you. I will make sure that I can never stop moving, and I'll do that for your sake, and then maybe that can help you. And in addition to that, there very often are beliefs and decisions that have to do much more particularly with someone's personal history rather than the history of their family, their own life, their own decisions. All of the things that go into generating kind of all of human experience. And most certainly they're present in the really difficult and painful stuff as well, obviously.
People, of course, know about therapists per se and about how they can talk back and forth with a therapist. How is neuro-linguistic programming similar to or different from what it might be like to go to a therapist?
There are some generalizations about that I've gotten pretty comfortable making over the years. Let's sort of presuppose the word in front of that, conventional therapy or conventional talk therapy, because there's so many kinds of therapies, so many methodologies and modalities, so many variations based on the practitioner or the school. I mean, I want to be really clear, I'm not a psychotherapist, I am not a licensed therapist. I've been working in this NLP model for 30 years plus, and I am not a licensed therapist. I like to tell people, I don't usually have to respond about that much anymore. I mean, for years and years and a couple of decades now, just about all of my practice has been based on referrals, but I used to tell people that The state of California, where I live, does not license me to do many things, and among these are smog inspections, cosmetology, and psychotherapy. So the main difference is that when one is doing therapy, one is talking about feelings and the content of one's life. What's going on, what went on, what are the experiences, what are the conditions, what are the events, and so forth. And then the emotions or the feelings that go with that, or that, you know, we want to be there or we want not to be there, and so forth. In NLP, we do pay attention to the content, because obviously no one has a content-free life. But the thing that NLP contributes originally, and I think still uniquely, is an ability to track, to observe, to work with how humans are creating their experience, not just what the experience is or why it's going on, which is essentially a story about it. Some stories are more useful than others, and they all change periodically based on fashion and where the focus of a community or culture is. But what NLP pays attention to is how. And when I say how, what we notice is that all experience is made up of combinations of pictures and sounds and feelings and smells and tastes. Our creature senses. We take any moment of a human's experience, and if we could freeze frame it and slice it really thin, so to speak, and stick it under some kind of exotic microscope, we would find that moment of experience, wanted or unwanted, horrific or blissful, whatever it is, that moment is made up of a particular combination of internal and external pictures and sounds and feelings or smells and tastes too. And what we do in NLP is we have ways of paying attention to the physiology of the client, and in other words, how they move, how they breathe, how, you know, what their skin color is doing, what all kinds of other little relatively subtle indicators are doing, what they're doing with their eyes, their voice tone, their breathing. And we can notice, it's kind of like, in a kind of a crude analogy, running a computer program forward step by step by step by step. And we're looking to find out, in this case, where does it get itself into trouble? Where does it go sideways? Where does it go dysfunctional? So, for example, if someone goes, you know, the context much simpler and easier to work with than Parkinson's symptoms. But supposing someone goes to work in the morning, as soon as they see their office door, they start to feel sort of miserable and depressed. We would ask them essentially, well, gee, how are you doing that? Now, their conscious answer would be, I don't know. I just go to work and I get depressed. I see my door and I get depressed. We can pay attention to their experience. We can essentially slow it down, run it forward, almost frame by frame. We can find the moment when they see their office door before the system starts to load the bad feeling or the depressed feeling. And we can just catch right at that moment, right there, that there is something in that sequence that probably doesn't belong there. It's a picture of something really difficult or something really awful or something really depressing, basically, from long ago and far away, usually. And their neurology, in an effort to keep them well and safe, until some kind of intended positive outcome, has sort of inserted that picture or that sound or that recording of someone's voice, inserted it right into that spot, which then sort of tips the whole program over sideways, and then it all becomes a pattern for managing, not trying, you know, managing feeling bad or trying not to feel too bad. So the question that NLP asks is, well, you know, to a client, we essentially say, what would you like? And then we say, what stops you? But the answer that comes from what stops you isn't words. We're not really interested in the words. I mean, we're kind of courteous and respectful about the words. Sometimes they're helpful. But what we can do is we can notice the person, listen to something, make a picture of something, or out of their conscious awareness, just load an entire spurious, not relevant, bunch of old safety patterning is what it comes down to. from long ago and far away, sometimes generationally far away, and sometimes just, you know, from being 3 years old or 13 years old and so forth. So we change those internal sequences, those what we call the sequences of internal representations. We directly discover where the system is getting itself turned upside down, what would work better to fulfill the client's desired outcomes, and then we revise the patterns really directly. And this is all done with talking and with words, but occasionally there's a squeeze on the arm or a request to look here or there in the room and so and that kind of stuff. It's very low-key. It looks like talk therapy from the outside if you don't know or really know what you're watching. But we're actually picking up the dysfunctionality in the person's internal safety programs that are kind of wrecking their present state, which is to say their current life.
Then if I were to have visited you and I dealt with the problem of freezing and having awful emotions every time I reached my office door, we would work with that, and then would you provide me with exercises that I need to do when I come home? Or would there be some homework assignments, or would I need to work with this problem with you for 6 months or 8 months, or how does that work exactly?
But the short answer before is no, there's usually not homework. We revise the structure that generates the person's experience, their behavior, or their capability, or their beliefs about the world, or their beliefs about themselves in that world. We put the revisions in, arrange for them to integrate in. The behavior changes usually are immediate, like we can disconnect a phobia of decades, you know, decades-old phobia in essentially a minute or less. Sometimes it takes 2 hours to make that 1 minute be okay. Make it okay, the person doesn't actually have this response they've been putting up with that causing, you know, that's caused so much pain. It takes 2 hours to make it okay that it only takes a minute to change it. So there's usually not homework. The beliefs change, identity change. This is not typically a one session thing because these are layer upon layer upon layer upon layer structures, as you might imagine, that stabilize the person's sense of themselves, that stabilize the world that identity moves around in and lives in. If we're doing relatively straightforward behavior level change, so this is someone who, to use that example again for a moment, sees their office door and feels bad. This is probably something that would be easily revisable in one session, very straightforwardly. We put the change into the person's system, we integrate it in certain ways, and then it just stays there if there is not an objection. And the objection is, or all of the objections to otherwise wonderful and positive change are what we call issues of ecology, the ecology of personal change, or the ecology of healing. A behavior change can be made really quickly and directly if there's not an ecology objection. Most of the actual clock time is about uncovering, getting into respectful relationship with the objections to the change or the healing. Getting into respectful relationship with the objections in the person's system. We presuppose that all experience has an intended positive outcome. If change doesn't go in, or if it doesn't stay in, because sometimes the change sort of falls out, this falling out of the change, or where the revision won't hold, is always a consequence of unaddressed ecology. A really, really simple example of that, again, in terms of behavior, that person I was talking about with the office door was a client from decades ago. Well, his system objected to being able to see his office door and not feel bad. This was part of his commitment to the people he worked with. Part of his commitment to them, sort of almost explicitly, was to completely revile the company that he and they worked for. That was part of his job, actually. He had a certain kind of function in the company. And sort of an ombudsman kind of function, but more than that. the question we ask is, is there anything that you might lose that you value when you can have a good and proper change? And the answer is, well, yeah, I might lose, in this man's case, yeah, I might lose my attention to or my energy on or my devotion to my people. So we had to find a way to make it possible for him to see his office door and simultaneously sustain his attention to his really strong commitment to these people that he worked with. So that's a two-stage process. What would you like? What stops you? Is there anything that you might lose that you value when you can have the experience you would like?
I'm wondering if there is something in particular that you could recommend to an individual who has the symptoms of Parkinson's, just in general, that they could do that might help them get some relief from their symptoms, or everything that you've really talked about is really very specific, and that the answer really is that it really depends on the specific person's reality and experience and the possibility that they might have an unconscious wish not to heal.
Or, as we might just translate that, a really big ecology objection to being well.
At a very observable level, one of the common symptoms of people with Parkinson's is anxiety. And it sounds like from what you're explaining, if a person were to focus on specific event or events that create the anxiety, that it would be possible in working with an NLP therapist to be able to find some pretty quick relief from that anxiety.
Yes, that part of it, assuming the practitioner knows what they're doing and knows how to elicit and track and work with this kind of material. I mean, if you and I were sitting right now with a client, let's say you were observing, I would look at the client and say, okay, so you've been kind of making yourself crazy with anxiety. And I'm kind of, yes, fine. And I would ask a really simple question. What lets you know to be anxious right that way in that moment? And the person's conscious self would look at me as if, you know, I've been asked some really stupid questions in regard to this Parkinson's stuff, but that's got to be the dumbest one. And simultaneously, just before they kind of had that thought, their body would do certain things, their eyes would move in certain ways, and they would show us the internal out-of-consciousness soundtracks and old pictures that their brain, and when I say their brain, I don't mean the brain involved with Parkinson's, I just mean their what we call the creature brain, the critter brain, the brain that is patterned to have an automatic no-choice response to certain stimuli. Their brain has just shown itself a picture of something very much worth being anxious about. That picture, or perhaps it's a soundtrack, the picture doesn't happen to correspond to present time. That's the problem. So it's a picture of something worth being concerned or fearful about, usually from long ago and far away. It's been patterned in by the system so that every time there's a certain stimulus in the environment or another maybe thought pattern that tees up the representations, the pictures, sounds, and feelings that go with the experience of anxiety, whatever it is that tees that up, then the brain fires off the anxiety response in an unworkable effort to keep the person well and safe long ago and far away. In other words, that the cause of anxiety, although there's much to be anxious about perhaps, but that particular anxiety, that's not about right now. And if it is about right now, then the author really high that right behind the concern about right now, when I say behind, I mean like in the person's mind's eye, right behind, or in their mind's ear, just right over there, another part of their of themselves that is not conscious is listening to and watching something. That if you and I were listening to and watching it, we would have the same response that they are. One of the difficulties of being human is that we have many different brains in our skulls, and the interface among them is pretty buggy. And the creature neurology, which is in charge of basic safety and self-preservation and all of that stuff from 100 million BC somewhere, I don't even know if it has a sense that it's part of a human being, but it just has one instruction, which is to make sure that we do not perish. And so the success indicator it uses is a question, and doesn't speak, and it doesn't talk, and it doesn't analyze. It just creates associations. But for this example, if it did talk, if it did speak, it would only use one success indicator, which is the answer to the question, are we dead yet? And unfortunately, if the answer is no, we're not dead yet, then it has the impression, although it's not conscious, so it doesn't have impressions, it just has the impression that what it's doing is working beautifully. Because here we are. Now, the human being who is appended on top of that critter brain, with an identity and a history and a complex experience of being, you know, a primate and a human and a soul here in time space, that human being is just kind of miserable or going nuts with this. But the creature patterning just keeps running what it does again and again and again until we can reach in and revise it. In NLP, essentially, we can kind of plug a keyboard into that creature neurology so that we can put some change into it, because it doesn't speak English or Spanish or Chinese or any other high-level language. Its programming language is pictures, sounds, feelings, smells, and tastes. And so in this kind of extreme analogy, we sort of plug a keyboard in, and then we can gently put some change into that system so that it revises the pattern it uses to keep us well and safe, to kind of bring all of that into something that's congruent with present time. In Parkinson's, there's so much going on. There's so much present tense distress, obviously. And then there's so much past difficulty to which the Parkinson's is, in some way or other, a sensible and congruent and useful response, albeit utterly, you know, heartbreaking and difficult for the human beings who are involved with it.
The issue for many people who are listening and reading this is that they really are very much self-help people. They like to do things on their own, and yet a lot of what you describe involves a person who is trained in observing body behavior and seeing some insights that the person's not aware of or not conscious of. Is there anything a person can do for themselves using NLP if they just really don't want to go and make an appointment to see a trained NLP therapist?
Sure. There is a dimension of NLP that is entirely, we might call it, self-inflicted. There's a really wonderful book called Introducing NLP by a couple gentlemen named O'Connor and Seymour. Those are their last names. And there are several others as well. People can learn to redirect their attention, redirect their, and I was just about to say redirect their thinking. Now, redirecting one's thinking is part of just about every kind of change format in the world, except the utterly and totally body-based interventions. In NLP, we would never say to someone, why don't you change your thoughts, and then you can change your life. If the person could redirect their thoughts that well, that easily, they probably would already be doing it. Again, there's an intended positive in the dysfunction they're experiencing. So their efforts to revise things for themselves tend to kind of bounce off and sometimes even backfire, except when they don't. And when they don't, of course, we can all celebrate. There is in the NLP toolbox some really simple stuff. It has a profound effect on how things feel. And how things feel determines, to a great extent, what things mean. And one of the old observations is that it's not what is going on in our lives that counts, it's what is going on means that actually matters. So, in a really simple way, if somebody makes a picture, for example, you might try this, or your readers and listeners might try this, just ask yourself for a second to think of a pleasant memory. So this is about the most simple sort of NLP change we have, but I think in a moment you'll notice the kind of effect that even this very simple change can produce. So if you think of a pleasant memory, then to do that, you've probably had to use at least two sensory systems. You've probably had to make pictures, look at pictures in your mind's eye in some way, sort of flip through a scrapbook visually, and you've also had to pay attention to how the pictures feel. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to pick out a pleasant memory. So it's the picture part of that instruction, please recall a pleasant memory. It's the internal visual part that tells us that it's memory, you know, it's this memory and right here and not that memory over there. So if we don't have pictures, unless we're doing it in some other way like with sound, which would be not unheard of, but relatively rare, you know, how are we supposed to tell this memory from that memory unless we have a picture of what this memory is and a picture or pictures that go with that memory? What's the difference between a memory of picking up one's Nobel Prize a few years ago and, you know, making the airplane in Los Angeles and just in the nick of time? The main difference is a picture. Okay? So that's how we sort them out visually, and then they go with or they produce feelings. That's how we sort them out emotionally. So if you think of this picture that goes with a pleasant memory, notice the content, notice the feeling, notice the meaning that goes with the picture or the memory, whatever that is, big deal meaning or little deal meaning, doesn't matter. And then I'll simply ask you and your listeners and readers to notice now, in a way perhaps you haven't before, when you look at that picture in your mind's eye, is the picture in color or black and white? This is our most elementary distinction. If you are doing this, do you have a picture that's
color? It's color, yeah.
Okay. So this is usually the case with pleasant memories, not always. Now, well, just imagine that you can grab hold of the color control knob in your brain and turn it so you take all the color out of the picture. Take it from color to black and white.
Okay.
It's really simple. Freeze frame it there. Then the question is, how does that change affect the feeling or the meaning if it does?
Well, for me, it's a lot flatter.
Okay. This is usually the experience, not always. And so if you put the color back into the picture, and so we're doing a little tiny microscopic change on manual. You know, our brains are doing, you know, tens of billions of these calculations per split second in order to generate our experience. And this is part of our patterning, right? Your brain has been instructed, it has coding instructions to record that memory with that color. If it had recorded that memory without that color, you might not have picked it as a pleasant memory because it was too flat. So put it back into color, then put more color in, kind of super saturated a little bit, try the other side of the spectrum a little bit, and just keep putting more color in until it means the wrong thing, until it's no longer the same memory. It doesn't have the same feeling. It's the same content. It's you getting your Nobel Prize or whatever. Yeah? But the feeling is different. The meaning is different.
Oh, right, right. That does happen, doesn't it?
And then set it back to where you would like it. Maybe your brain had it correctly set up, or maybe just a little bit more color would be useful. And then we'll try a couple more just really fast images. The next one would be brightness. This is like the brightness control on a television. So look at that very same picture, and now we'll just turn the brightness down so the picture nearly disappears the way it would on a TV screen. And then notice how that affects the feeling or the meaning. If it does, not all changes affect all meaning or feeling.
Yeah, that one creates more fear for me.
Okay, this is also very common. Set the brightness back to where you would like it. Some people might get a much better feeling as a function of that little change. It varies individual and by individual, and experience by experience, and moment by moment in that internal neurolinguistic patterning or neurolinguistic programming. So set the brightness to where you like it, and then put more brightness in. Just keep, you know, making it brighter and brighter and brighter until the picture just kind of flashes out entirely. And then freeze frame it at that end. Notice what that feels like. And then set it where you would like it.
Then you tone it down to the place where it feels good. Is that the idea?
It feels good or better.
Or better. Uh-huh. And so what I've done is reprogrammed that memory and that imprinting of the memory in my whole mental system.
Doing actually is just making some adjustments with those little color and brightness controls. These changes probably won't stay permanently, but there's a way of working with it that would cause it to stay permanently. Like just in case when someone thinks of their future, right, they end up with a a kind of a dark picture that is colorless. It's going to go just automatically because of how we are wired, how we're organized as humans. It's going to go with some pretty bad feelings. But maybe making that brighter and adding in color that might make the future more available, or it just might make the feelings much worse. Because if the pictures of the future are quite negative, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we make them brighter and add color, we're just going to increase the negative feeling. So there's no telling exactly, like I can't give a blanket instruction, except that if you're not having the feeling about something that you want, check the picture that goes with the event, whether it's a memory or whether it's something about the future. And notice the color, notice the brightness. You can also notice how big the picture is in your mind's eye. Is it a postage stamp? Is it a panoramic wraparound? And these kinds of changes one can then make manually, but they do, if they're done correctly, that they can stay and they will hold. And then the next time the brain accesses that, it's given a different coding. The content is the same. We haven't changed the content. It's that same memory or the same imagination of the future. But what changes is how it is delivered, and how it is delivered, as we notice here, has as much to do with what it means and how it feels as what it is. Right? You imagine yourself moving properly and feeling really well. If that's imagined with the wrong brightness or the wrong color or the wrong size or the wrong distance, and when I just say the wrong, I mean one that does not work, then it still won't feel right. So there are some really simple formats for paying attention to, for noticing and changing these things in ourselves, especially if there's someone with us who can ask us, so when you're thinking about that, is that all dark again, or does that get bright and colorful, or is it too colorful, and so forth. That kind of thing is rather easily done.
As I understand the explanation, then, there are no judgments about whether the scene needs to be in color or black and white or bright or dull. The key issue, then, is in just sorting through my own reactions to whatever the scene might be that I'm looking at, and then making the adjustments to see what happens when I make the adjustments that is brighter or duller or more color or less color. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. We have no preconceived ideas of what's correct or what's proper. The question is, what is it that will work to produce the desired experience? In NLP, our main questions are, if someone is experiencing something that they don't want, we always ask, well, how are they doing that? I mean, not why, but how. Like, literally, how is their brain doing that? What are the representational events going on inside, and among millions of them there are these things like color and brightness. How are they producing experiences that they don't want, and where does it happen that what they want doesn't seem to matter anymore? I want to feel positive and upbeat, and I still don't. Right now, if we check out how they're doing it, it might have whatever combination of distance, color, brightness, movement, or still, and so forth. There are about a dozen of these basic distinctions. We're just wondering, well, if it's not feeling the way you want, what would feel better, and how do we get your brain to do that, assuming that you don't have an objection? And if you do have an objection, by all means, let's notice it, because the change won't hold, or it will fall out. Let's find out what is the intended positive, that feeling better would be a violation. Again, what might we lose that we value if we could actually create what we want rather than have the experience that we can?
Ah, that's fascinating. Do you always want to work with a person who's present to you physically, given that you need to look at how they're looking and where they're looking with their eyes and how they're breathing? Or do you work with people long distance, as we just did for a few minutes, you and I together here?
I prefer always to work with people in person and work with clients, except on the days I'm teaching. I pretty much work with clients all day, every day. So having said that, this can also be done on the telephone, but it can't be done on the telephone in the same way. I know some practitioners who are quite gifted at working on the phone. I have the luxury of having my days full with people who are willing to come to my office. But I know some folks who work with it really well. There are some, there are some people who are quite gifted at being able to listen for change in voice and breathing and be able to notice the auditory expression of these kinds of visual changes that we were just talking about. I do it also, but again, I don't have to most days, so I don't. What I would encourage people to do is to, if they can, to go work with a practitioner who can get a sense of how they're organized, who can see them and listen to them for a bit, and then very often after that, things can be done properly on the telephone. This is very, very far away from what would be called coaching work. The objective of the NLP practitioner, or at least our kind of NLP practitioner, to work with the person's patterning so that the client has the experience that the client wants to have, and this is really important, and the client does not have to remember to be different. Our objective is to find out how the human system is creating what they don't want, revise it so it does generate what they do want, and then put those changes in and then let the whole beautiful system operate with that patterning just as consistently and persistently and maybe obstinately as it was running the old pattern. There is good work to be done on the telephone. It's a little hard to get high-quality information about the person's internal process. It's a little harder, or a lot harder, to do on the telephone. But sometimes when we're discussing issues of belief and identity, that can be worked with very, very successfully on the phone. Someone is having Parkinson's symptoms, we would ask, what might someone believe in order to have this experience? Or what would someone have to believe in order to have this experience just the way it is? And the person might say, well, they'd have to believe they have Parkinson's symptoms. And we would say, yes, we understand that is the experience. And what would they have to believe to have that experience? And then we're almost immediately into some really interesting territory. They would have to believe that they have no choice, or there's something wrong with them, or they're failed or faulty in some way, and so forth. We presuppose that no one is broken, no one is dysfunctional. Everyone's system is working beautifully with the instructions that it has to produce what it has been asked to produce. Mm-hmm. Our job is to get in there and revise those instructions so that they can fulfill the true desires and not the outcomes from the old safety patterning long ago and far away.
You're in California, and so the other question is, how would people get in touch with you if they wanted to do that?
The organization that I am part of is called NLP Marin, Marin being the county where we are in California, just a little bit north of San Francisco. So our website is nlpmarin.com. And there is lots and lots and lots on the web about NLP. I must say, a whole lot of it, in fact, a great deal of it, is absolute trash. There is a version of NLP that is kind of the infomercial level of NLP. That is designed toward basically, you know, how to have a huge effect on people and make sure they don't have any effect on you. I just can't begin to describe how unpleasant and ugly that kind of stuff is. That's so far away from what we do in my organization. And there's some other very fine ones around the country, too, so I just want to caution people. About 80% of what you're probably going to find on the web is probably either garbage or nonsense. There are some extremely fine centers. There is a referral center called NLP Practitioner, nlppractitioner.com, that has a pretty comprehensive list, although it's not, well, a pretty extensive list. There is a center in Santa Cruz that is operated by one of the founders of NLP, a man named Robert Diltz. Robert is an extraordinary man, an amazingly creative guy. He was one of the first ones in Santa Cruz with John Grinder and Richard Bandler. Robert's organization is top flight, first class, and I don't know how they're set up to offer referrals, but that's one of the places I would send people to first. They're also welcome to contact us.
And you also train therapists in your clinic, do you not?
Yes, we have a training center, and it's not just therapists. We do have some therapists who come to take our courses, but our courses are for any human being who interacts with any other human being at any time and we add on, including themselves. And so we start with the very basics of NLP, what we call the foundations of communication and change. attention. And there's a level of training above that called advanced communication exchange. We have several master's level trainings and post-master's trainings. And so the remarkable thing about NLP, at least as we do it, is that if used with respect, with very deep respect for the client and what the client is experiencing, a little bit goes a long way, which is why our foundations of communication change courses. So although it's rather short, it's not a survey class. It actually is immensely useful for working with people. So we have a lot of folks who are in business or a lot of educators, a lot of people who are doing the currently fashionable coaching and so forth who come to be our students.
So
it goes a long way.
So it would be possible, if somebody is called to learn more about this, to go in two directions. One would be to find a therapist to work with. Another might be to just attend one of your workshop seminars and just decide they wanted to immerse themselves in finding out everything they could about NLP. Is that right?
That is correct, although they're extremely welcome to start out with their toes rather than with full immersion. We do routinely free seminars, probably 20 times a year, where we introduce the subject matter and give people about a three-hour experience of the kind of change, those little change patterns that can, properly done, can stack up and become so immensely powerful. We do that about 20 times a year, and that is entirely free. One just needs to be in the neighborhood of San Francisco.
So somebody could just find out from your website when you're holding those, and it's basically free. It would be a whole introduction to what NLP is all about.
Entirely free, and we get lots of feedback that it's a three-hour introduction, and it really is a three-hour introduction. So when you asked me before what is NLP, I gave the very short version. It usually takes me 3 hours.
You mentioned some of the challenges with the misinformation on the internet about NLP. You've mentioned a few resources. Do you have other books or tapes or CDs that you would recommend people might look at to find out more about it?
On our website, we have a recommended reading list. Robert Diltz, Robert is an immensely prolific author, among as well as being an amazing teacher. Robert Diltz now is going to have lots and lots of material on his website. Alas, I spend, as I said, all day, every day doing this, and so I'm kind of the last person in the world who's very good at what the other resources are out there. I mean, I know about Robert because his organization is close to ours geographically in some other ways, and we have a lot of students who train with us and go train with him and come and, you know, and exchange and so forth. So that's why I can offer that information off the top of my head. If people were interested, they would be welcome to contact us and call us. The phone numbers are on the website, and as best we can direct them as best we can to some place closer to where they are geographically, or at least refer them to someone who can refer them to someone and so forth. NLP was never copyrighted. The letters are actually referred to. The copyrighted NLP is natural language processing. It's actually a computer programming language. So the way John and Richard did this allowed the body of knowledge to move out into the public domain. So there's lots of NLP. Anyone who wants to can fire up their laser printer and print themselves a handsome certificate as a galactic master of neurolinguistic programming. That in itself doesn't mean anything.
One of the questions people might have would be if they begin along this path, are they going to be seeing an NLP therapist for the rest of their life? Will they have to go every week? Is this the kind of thing that is like some therapies where it just never seems to end?
Oh, Lord, I certainly hope not. I can't speak for other practitioners. I usually work with people for 2 hours at a time, and we'll do that once a month or once every 6 weeks for a while, especially for doing more complex behavior and identity revision. And then they come back once a year or even less frequently outcome-focused. It's very outcome-directed. We want to find out, what are you experiencing that you do not want to be experiencing? And in the case of Parkinson's symptoms, that answer starts to be extremely obvious at the top layer, but there's some other very interesting layers, of course, underneath that. What are you experiencing that you don't want to be, or what are you not experiencing that you would like to experience? Presupposing your system is doing the very best it can to deliver exactly what you want. It's got some conflicting instructions, some hugely overlapping criteria, kind of built-in blocks as it tries to find out the best way to deliver what's really wanted. We reach in there as best we can. We create revisions. We let the person integrate those. So ideally, it's 5 or 6 sessions over a period of 5 or 6 months would be how I would work with most things.
People are most interested in finding approaches that will provide them with relief. And it sounds like from everything you said that given there's a commitment on their part to proceed, that it is possible that they can get some relief from symptoms if they pursue this route. Of the people you've seen, it sounds like around half, give or take a few points, have seen relief, and then the other half haven't. Is that about the gist of it?
Yes. Yes. Short answer, yes. Whatever it is that in the folks who don't have who don't experience an improvement, or, well, that's the simplest way to say it, there are objections or complications, and by complications I mean entanglements in the larger family system that I simply have not been able to be useful about.
Right.
Very, very bluntly.
There are many people who believe that once a person is diagnosed with Parkinson's, they're going to always get worse. But from my understanding of what you've said, you have worked with individuals who have the symptoms of Parkinson's who have gotten better. Now, is that right?
That's correct.
So that's going to be good news for a lot of people. That yes, it is possible to feel better.
It is possible to feel better, yes. And yes, let me just, because I'm right there, I would need to start to talk about 20 different things simultaneously. So we just leave that yes there. And then with the caveat, of course, that it all depends and all of those other things that are kind of so heartbreaking and so difficult but still necessary to say.
Right. So for people who are listening and reading this, what is the one thing that you'd really like for them to know about NLP?
That NLP is a respectful and elegant format, change format, healing format, self-discovery format for assisting people to fully respect the experience that they have created for themselves and that they are having. Especially when that experience just seems about impossible to appreciate or respect. That properly done, what we want to do is to bring the person into a very deep rapport with themselves, with their own creative force, with their own creative events, with the larger creative forces that they participate in terms of their own internal world, their own identity, and their family as well, and sometimes their family across generations. What properly done NLP can do, especially if I can just give my own organization another mention, we never seek to overcome or defeat anything that's going on within us or with anyone else. All we ever seek to do is respect the intended positive that is behind it all, to include it, again, with respect, and allow it to transform so that it's producing the experience the person truly wants. Doing NLP change work is a process of coming into deep, deep respect for oneself and for all of the intentions, conflicting though they may be, that operate inside of us humans.
This is something, then, that I can, if I had Parkinson's, that I can do for myself. So it's not a question of going to a therapist and they're doing something to me. This is really a self-motivated, self-guided approach for being able to find relief from symptoms. And it's facilitated by a very experienced therapist.
Yes, yes. I will underline again, yes, it's an NLP practitioner may be a licensed therapist. Very often they're not.
Uh-huh, right.
The change work is done within the individual and within the individual's consciousness and their relationship with themselves and the larger system that they're part of. The therapist or the practitioner, to say it more accurately, doesn't do anything but facilitate a change in relationship and an internal process for the client. And this is very often very strong and very, very beautiful change work.
Is there any question I haven't asked that I needed to ask you?
A lot of good NLP change work is really a process of education and, as I mentioned a second ago, a revision of relationship with self. This process continues. So what a good practitioner will do is work with the client to show the client how to continually include and then revise the patterning that's creating their experience, that's generating their beliefs, and the way those beliefs outpicture out into their world. So it is very much something that one does for oneself, and one gets a bit of a jump start, often in a really remarkable way from a practitioner.